Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2011, Watson made its debut on the television trivia game show Jeopardy.
And now the newcomer, developed and programmed especially for this moment, making its first appearance on our national television program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Watson.
The big differences between Watson and two of the game's greatest players that competed that day are that Watson is a computer, and also Watson won by a lot. Watson is one example of what we might mean when we refer to artificial intelligence, at least so far. But was Watson more gimmick than real intelligence? That's what we're talking about today. We'll consider fictional representations from the movies and talk about what is actually possible, at least today. Joining us in the studio from the Ohio State University Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research is Jim Davis. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Jim, you told us before we went on the air that you've been involved in this since you were in an undergrad. You've been excited about this.
Yeah, it was an interesting story. When I was an undergraduate at University of Central Florida, I saw a flyer on the wall looking for undergraduate researchers and doing some AI work. And I thought that was interesting. And I started there, actually published some research, went on to MIT for my graduate degree, and then I came straight to Ohio State and still working in this artificial intelligence field.
And so how would you describe the changes or the progress that has been made since you were an undergrad?
Well, a lot of it's been more of applied work that's been coming out these days. A lot of times in the past, it's been developing all these algorithms and thoughts and symbolic reasoning programs. And now, actually, it's embedded in a lot of our society. You look at all of the companies that are out there. Video games have a large amount of AI inside of them. Every company that you've already heard of, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, IBM, all of these companies are now involving IBM in their products. And, you know, 10 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that. So today, it's actually, you know, part of our society.
So what do we mean by artificial intelligence today?
There's lots of definitions. I'd probably say the most concise one to me would be, like the science and engineering of trying to build intelligent machines. Now, primarily, you would think of intelligent computer programs, but again, robotics is a huge thing that's coming out these days. So it's also the embodiment in the machines, but also the computer software.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about artificial intelligence this hour. My guest for the hour is Jim Davis. He's a researcher at Ohio State University's Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also going to be talking about the depiction of artificial intelligence in the movies, which is how most of us know about the concept. If you have a favorite movie you want to mention, give us a call, 614-292-8513. When you're talking about IBM or any of the companies that use artificial intelligence and all the ways that it's been incorporated into our daily lives, we're not yet talking about machines that have feelings.
I would say that's correct for the most part. Now, there are researchers actually working on emotional intelligence.
Really? For the most part, yes. That's correct.
I would, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I mean, some people would say, I absolutely don't want that. Let's go back to the Star Trek computer on the Enterprise. Are they having a conversation with it? Are they having their telling about their bad day they had? No, it's more of like, you know, a query system. Let me ask you a question, give me the answer. And so the famous Watson system that was created by IBM that played Jeopardy, that's not something you're going to sit down and tell about your day. You're going to ask it these questions and then see what you can get back in this information.
And even more significantly, in a way, it's not going to sit down and tell you about its day.
I probably wouldn't want to hear about it personally.
right.
But it's coming. And I mean, there's lots of situations where people are trying to worry or not worry, but actually study more of, you know, could I interact with a computer in a more natural way that it seems more human-like? So we've seen these robotic vacuum cleaners that are running around your house these days. Do you ever want to talk to that? Someone might be saying, I want to treat it like a pet. You know, it's like a dog or cat around your house and, you know, say, come over here. And it comes up to you and you can say, oh, that was nice. Good job. And it actually might blink some lights back at you or smile or actually respond to you. And some people may want that. Some other people might, you know, keep that off.
Yeah. So how much is the development of our artificial intelligence the development of how we feel about it?
I would say that that's not like a core area of the AI field. It's probably more of the side field where people want to see how does that actually interact with human society. Now, that's obviously an aspect. And there's been people would say, we're never going to accept these intelligent machines in society until they have that that human characteristic. They might have to have a face. They might have to have an expression they could tell us. They might be able to give us some kind of notion of interaction between them.
What about something like Siri? Would that be considered artificial intelligence?
So let me just start
by saying,
which
is, of course, the person or the thing you talk to on your iPhone.
Yeah, it's debatable. Some people would say yes because it can work with you and respond to you, and other people would say no, that it's not true intelligence, more of tricks that it can basically figure out what you need and then just give you that information back. So this is a touchy subject in the field of saying, what do you mean by intelligence? I mean, there's other people that come back and say, hey, I think intelligence is really the ability to solve, say, really hard problems, but, you know, real fast and efficient for you, rather than just trying to, you know, understand your speech and then just give you an answer back from its database. So it really depends on who you talk to.
What are you teaching about cognitive computing and artificial intelligence at OSU now? And how does that differ from maybe your undergraduate experience or your graduate experience?
I myself teach a class on a survey of artificial intelligence. So we start back at the birth of AI when it all came out.
Which was?
Actually, I should ask you, do you know what the date is? You want to guess?
In the 40s?
Very, very close. It's right around the 50s is when it really started to come out. And the actual, the launch date of the term artificial intelligence came out in 1956.
Okay.
So it's actually a relatively new field.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I cover that and we cover it up to today. We go everything through all the history, all of the things that have been coming out recently, all of the press that comes online. We cover all of that. We either have other more advanced AI classes about the machine learning techniques. And we were mentioning Watson earlier, and now we're actually starting a new course, and I think it's going to launch this coming year, about incorporating that IBM Watson technology into a project-based class on campus, which is going to be really exciting.
Where they need to use the technology to make something that you can use every day?
Absolutely. So it's still, so IBM has
once again, the application.
Yeah. So you can change the application around to what you need. It's more of the, you know, it's how do you interface and answer these questions within a large database? But the class will be more project-oriented, that the students will break into teams, and IBM's graciously opened this software to lots of universities to incorporate in their curriculum. And so another faculty member in our department is spearheading that, and I think we're going to launch that this year.
Okay, let's take a call from a listener who wants to talk about Watson. Hi, Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Ever since that Watson thing happened, which was fun to watch, I watched it and everything, I decided it was really not a fair representation of what was really going on. Those guys were plenty smart. Now, they didn't have all the, I mean, well, they had a lot of the stuff, but Watson didn't have to listen and read those things. That was being fed to Watson by, an ASCII file. So Watson had an advantage that the people didn't have. They had to look at the thing and decide when Alex was done saying it and when they could push the button. And Watson had an advantage there because he was being fed it by ASCII rather than just reading it. No, he didn't have to use his eyes, Watson.
In other words, he wasn't human.
Well, he didn't have to, you know, the human computer has eyes and ears and all those kinds of things. And Watson was phenomenal, but it just didn't seem like they should concede it to him, because he'd have to go a long way to be able to do those things with just by visually looking at a screen, which is what the contestants were doing. They didn't have somebody feeding that question in them. If Watson had to decide, you know, a word that's a homonym or something like that, visually it'd be different than if it's been fed an ASCII question. So that's, I just want to get that off my chest, see if anybody else felt that way.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. Jim Davis?
Yeah, Steve, that's a great comment. So my own research is in computer vision. How do you actually interpret images and pictures? So I 100% agree with him on that aspect. I think if I remember correctly how they set that up, it was almost sent to him or Watson as like a text message. And now there's obviously going to be some time delay. And, you know, our visual processing is amazingly fast. So as soon as we see it on the screen, we're done. Mm-hmm. So by the time it receives that text message, it parses it and do it, there is going to be some lag. And I don't know exactly what that lag was for it. I thought it was interesting that it actually had a mechanical button pusher. If you actually look at the podium, you'll see like this mechanism, like a plunger sitting on top of the button that will actually activate. So they did that part. But the front part, yes. And this is still my supposition why we don't see a lot of robots and things running around today is because their visual system is just not up to par in a general vision sense. Now, we can make things work really well in limited environments like, say, a manufacturing plant. You know, you've got the assembly line coming down through your fixed cameras looking at it. They know what they need to do, and it's a controlled environment. But in these random environments, it's really, really, really hard. So I can kind of see why they didn't do that, because that wasn't the stress of what they were trying to show with Watson. It was more of the, you know, the reasoning and being able to understand the questions and get the answers out. But I will agree with you on that aspect. It would be great if it could go ahead and do the visual.
So what is the ASCII? Steve was mentioning that, what was he talking about?
It's just imagine getting a text message.
Okay.
That's how it was working. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's how it actually worked from my memory here, that it would receive the question from someone that got that, and then it would take it from there. That way, because the computer can obviously take a message like that and parse it really easily.
We've done whole shows on the idea of space and how people negotiate space and negotiate the world around them just physically. Is that what you're talking about? Just humans, you know, it's amazing what humans can do with that. And that's something that the robots still, they haven't been able to get them onto that level.
It's the level of perception in general. Yeah. Now, most people think of perception as vision, but perception is more general. I mean, you have touch and hearing and all those other sensations that are going on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, there's people working on like smart skin that you can put on these robotics and platforms and like that, that you can actually touch it and it would realize how much pressure is being put to it so it could actually react to it. But again, the vision one is a really hard one. Let me put it this way. So when you have an image that you take from your phone and you look at it, you know, on your computer, it's just basically a matrix of numbers. Those numbers represent how bright each pixel is, if it's color, you know, what's the actual color. That's all a computer gets. So think of it as a big Excel sheet full of numbers. It has to basically look at that Excel sheet of numbers and say, oh, this is a picture of an old lady sitting at a bench and there's a small dog next to her and there's three trees and there's a blue car in the background. How do we do that? Now it becomes even harder that now you've got a robot navigating through the world, and it just doesn't have one image, but it has thousands and thousands of images in a video sequence. So I've just compounded the problem immensely, and it's just a really hard problem.
And it's got to know whether there's a breeze coming up behind it that might blow leaves in front of it, and
yep.
All of those kinds of things that we take for granted.
Yeah, so there's people, obviously you've seen speech recognition. People, mm-hmm. I mean, you can buy this at Best Buy and
right.
put it on your computer. That's one aspect, but the other one is also listening to the sound environment itself, like you were saying. I hear somebody behind me. How did it know that? How do you train that? How do you build that up? So building all these sensations and then putting them all together is the big challenge. So each of us work in one little piece. I do vision. Someone else is doing speech. Someone else is doing touch. Someone else is doing audition. Now we all have to essentially talk to one another, put all this stuff back into a machine, and let it see if we can integrate it all. So it's that foundation of putting it together that's the hard part.
Now, if you're listening on radio right now, you can't see Jim Davis, but you might be seeing him on TV. You're the whole time you're talking about this. Your eyes are sparkling. You're smiling. You're so excited. I mean, this is you. There's a lot of stuff going on right now.
It's an exciting time. I mean, I think, I'm smiling because this is interesting work. It gets me out of bed in the morning and go in and do this. But it's a cool time to be. So think about, there's lots of technology that everyone's going to start to seeing. One of my favorites that I've got my eye on right now is, Amazon. So they're looking at trying to create automatic flying drones that will actually deliver your packages.
Which the FAA has kind of put the kibosh on for now.
But the aspect is, you know, what's the challenge?
Uh-huh.
Is it rules and regulations?
Could they do it?
Yeah. Or is it technology? And I think the technology is pretty darn close to making it happen from folks that I've talked to.
I think of them as like those owls in the Harry Potter series, you know. That's what I think. They'll come smashing into your house. You'll go, oh, that darn drone.
Well, I wonder. I mean, people might have seen the Google smart self-driving cars that, you know, build all the
yeah.
maps and things for you. I mean, now the questions, you know, the people have raised, who's legally in charge of the situation when it happens to have an accident, or what happens if somebody gets hurt? And, you know, I read some things that have been coming out and how the state of California has pushed these new passing certain laws that allow it to be street legal and all these sort of issues. But, I mean, the days are coming. Autonomous vehicles. Not remote control. So this is the big difference. So difference between robots and other remote-controlled vehicles is these robots are autonomous, that they're working, they're sensing, they're acting on their own. There's not a human sitting back there with a joystick driving it around. That's a big deal. That's a big change.
Big difference.
Yeah.
My guest is Jim Davis. He from the Ohio State University Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research. We're talking about artificial intelligence today. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about the philosophy that goes into the development of artificial intelligence. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Since the first programmable computer was built in the 1940s, people have been imagining the worst. What might happen if the technology we created somehow becomes conscious? In a TED Talk in 2013, American philosopher John Searle said that before we can assess a machine's consciousness, we must first subject consciousness itself to further research.
And the message I want to leave you with is consciousness has to become accepted as a genuine biological phenomena, as much subject to scientific analysis as any other phenomenon in biology, or for that matter, the rest of science.
Still with us is OSU computer scientist Jim Davis. He works at the Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research. And joining us now by phone from New York is Binghamton University philosophy professor Eric Dietrich. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
The Turing test was in the news recently when a supercomputer program called Eugene Goostman became the first machine to pass it. What is the Turing test?
The Turing test is a, you sit a human down and you have a machine in one room and a human in another room talking to the first human, and the machine passes the Turing test if the human can't tell if he's talking to a human in the one room or a machine in the other. In other words, if the machine can fool the human into thinking that it's a human, the machine is a human, then the machine has passed the Turing test.
Who came
up? So, for example, I'm passing the Turing test right now. For all you know, you're talking to a machine.
Yeah, sure. Jim Davis?
Yeah, that's a great explanation. It's also classically done where it's all over text. So this is a text-based conversation.
So I don't have the voice.
That's correct, yeah.
This very professorial voice that I'm going to associate with a philosophy professor.
Right.
So is the Turing test, in your opinion, Eric Dietrich, is that a good measure for artificial intelligence?
No, not at all. For one thing, the Turing test hasn't been passed, not really. The current Turing test, as I understand it, was that has been passed was really downgraded from how Turing originally envisioned it. But, there's so much more than talking. Stephen Harnad, for example, has proposed what he calls the total Turing test. That is, you have to be able to go for a walk with the machine. I mean, if you're hanging out with C-3PO, he's not only talking, he's picking up stuff, he's commenting on things. And, after a few minutes hanging out with C-3PO, you're going to think, well, holy mackerel, this thing is really intelligent. So the standard Turing test, the one that's based just on words and conversation, that's not robust enough.
Jim Davis, from where you sit at the Ohio State University Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research, is the Turing test at least a standard to pass, or is it a value?
There's certainly a value to it. I mean, I tend to agree that is this what intelligence is all about? I would probably say no. I would say a lot of the cases that we're seeing today, these are more like chatbot tests. Could you sit down and have a conversation with it? Now, is it actually trying to do something intelligent? Is it doing something important? A lot of these in the past have worked on little tricks. So one of the classics ones, there was a system called Eliza in the 1960s that someone came out with. And it was kind of like...
Weizenbaum.
Yes.
Right,
yeah, Joseph Weizenbaum in the 60s. And it was essentially a therapist, a computer therapist. You could go in and it comes up and it might say on the screen, hi, what brought you in today? And you could say, I'm feeling kind of down. You type that in and it would come back and say, well, tell me, why are you feeling down? And then you would have this conversation with it. But it was completely based on a series of tricks. So it looked for certain keywords that a psychoanalyst might look for, family, mother. And one of the classic lines that, I mean, you can trick it and find out these things. It would come back and say something you wouldn't expect. So, mm-hmm. for example, it would say, you could type in, I think necessity is the mother of invention. Inside the computer, it's saying, oh, mother, this is a key word. Let's get into this, the psyche of this person. It would come back and say, tell me more about your mother. So based on these template things, it would kind of break. Now, my one personal thought on this is if you look at this in not a testing scenario, if you logged online and you happen to, by mistake, get into one of these systems, my guess is, the technology today, it would fool you for quite a while. I believe that. But if I sat you down and said, okay, let's pressure point this, let's see if you could actually tell me or not of what's going on, you're going to try to break this system. So to me, there's two aspects, if you didn't know about it or if you do know about it. So it's give and take.
Eric Dietrich, what is the distinction from a philosophical point of view, I guess, between consciousness and intelligence for the sake of this discussion?
Well, it's standardly quite a robust distinction. Intelligence can be completely non-conscious, at least in theory. So intelligence is the ability to solve problems, draw inferences, construct plans, figure things out, categorize your world. So it's a long list of things. Consciousness is one thing. It is having what philosophers call a phenomenological experience. So, for example, the sonorous sound of my voice is a bit of consciousness. If you see some red or some green or some blue, those are all kinds of consciousness. If you taste an onion, smell a skunk, hear a baby, those are all kinds of consciousness. But they all come down to the same thing. They are phenomenological experiences. And you needn't be intelligent to have them. So, for example, it's very likely that lobsters are conscious. So when you toss a lobster in a pot of boiling water, it actually feels pain. The fact that it's not a very sophisticated brain doesn't mean anything. And the fact that the lobster isn't very intelligent doesn't mean anything. It still feels pain. So, octopus and certainly dogs and cats, all these creatures can feel. And that's consciousness. And as far as we know, it's independent of intelligence. So you don't need to be intelligent to have consciousness. And you don't need to be conscious to have intelligence.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about artificial intelligence this hour. My guest's Eric Dietrich. He's a professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. He's the editor of the Journal of Experimental and Theoretical Artificial Intelligence. Also, Jim Davis. He's a researcher at the Ohio State University Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research. Jim Davis, in your work, does that distinction come into play? Is that idea of consciousness something that at least people are looking at theoretically?
I mean, there are obviously some people looking at it. I'm not personally. Mm-hmm. There's two general categories of the AI. They call it a strong AI and a weak AI. The strong AI is essentially trying to build a mind in a computer. The weak AI viewpoint is more of, building something you can do some good intelligent processing. So, I mean, some people will have one side of the view and others, take the opposite approach. The work that I'm pretty much doing is not dealing with more of this conscious aspect. It's more of just, good intelligent processing algorithms that can get the job done.
Let me just interject there. We might, as far as we know, we're going to get in consciousness for free. So, for example, if we could build, we can't, but if we could build a C-3PO, I mean, we can't yet, but if we could, C-3PO is very, very likely to be conscious. And we would get that for free. We simply build the machine, and it does what it does, and we consciousness comes along with the construction for free. I mean, for example, as far as we know, the internet might be conscious right now. It's complex. There's a whole bunch of things going on. It looks a lot like a brain. So perhaps it's conscious, and we just don't know. For one thing, its consciousness would be quite different from ours, and that's going to matter. Still, the internet might be conscious. So we might get consciousness for free. It might just be the way the universe is constructed. If you put things together in such and such a way, you just get consciousness for free as part of the bargain.
Bonus.
Yeah.
Jim Davis?
Right. Yeah, there's an interesting thought experiment that this kind of all reminded me of, that it just, when I tell students this, it makes us all think a little bit. So imagine we have the technology, say a neuron in our brain we have some degenerative disease and it dies. If we have the technology to replace a small neuron, we're going quite far with biotech these days. Let's imagine we can do that. What if we start to replace this one? Tomorrow we replace another one, and further, we're going to keep replacing all this. Now, what happens in the end? Is there at some point in our brain that now we're somebody different? I mean, if we can successfully replace one, mm-hmm. what happens as we move and replace all of them? Are we no longer ourselves anymore? Is it something that's still, it's fine? And if that's the case, then we can essentially replicate our whole brain and experience inside of silicon.
With consciousness.
You know what John Searle believes?
Go ahead.
Interjected. John Searle thinks that as you replace each neuron, sort of the conscious world of the being that we're replacing each neuron in becomes more and more gray.
Right.
You know, colors start to fade and sounds start to stop becoming rich. Mozart's indistinguishable from, you know, the wind blowing. And pretty soon, consciousness fades altogether.
Now, we don't know that.
So, we don't know that, but that's absolutely right. Hmm. But that's John Searle's position when he said, consciousness is a biological phenomenon. He's not kidding about the biological.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be alive, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's Mac in Clintonville. You're on the air. Hi, Mac.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'd like to ask your guests, Drs. Dietrich and Davis, about the Ray Kurzweil's singularity. My own personal opinion is it's kind of nutty, but I don't know much about it.
Well, Mac, before you go on, tell us what you mean by singularity in Ray Kurzweil.
Okay, well, the singularity is this idea that human and machine intelligence will merge sometime in the next 20 to 20 years or so, mm-hmm. they think, and then we will, you know, we will then be sort of like, I don't know, we will be at the whims of this massively intelligent thing that is this combination of humans and machines. And then I think his vision is ultimately immortality, you know, uploading personalities to cyberspace and traveling the universe as pure intelligence. Okay. Do I have that right, guys,
yep.
pretty much?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to hear what you think, and I'll take that off the air. Thank
okay,
you.
Thanks, Mac.
Bye.
I think we're missing something crucial in artificial intelligence. We have tons of very, very clever applications. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on, and the vast majority of it is going on behind the scenes. But you see it in the journals, and there's just a lot of really nice stuff being done. But building something like me or like C-3PO or even like HAL, we just don't see how to get there from here. And it seems to me that we're missing something really crucial. And the singularity thing is a direct denial of that. I think we're in the same position as the people who used to glue feathers on their arms, stand on a cliff, jump, and flap. And it turns out that that's hopeless. I mean, there's no way that's going to work. And those people died. We're missing something like that. We're missing lift. We're missing a profound and unifying concept that's going to make all of this make sense. Now, given how complex the brain is, we're probably missing two or three things like lift. But there's no such thing as flight until you figure out lift and until you come up with the equations describing it. And it's the same thing, I think, with intelligence. Like I said, consciousness is going to probably be got for free. So with intelligence, we're missing something really crucial. We're missing, and I don't really have any idea what it is, but we're missing something, and it's on the order of lift. It's the sort of thing that's going to, it's the difference between having feathers glued to your arms versus the Wright brothers. And they knew all about lift. They had all kinds of equations describing how this flying machine of theirs was supposed to work. And guess what? It worked. So the first flight wasn't that far, but still, it worked. And planes had actually been flying quite a bit before that, model planes, using the notion of lift. We're missing something like that. And this notion of the singularity actually... denies that. I mean, it's basically saying once the power gets big enough, we'll be good to go. I just don't think that's true.
Jim Davis?
Yeah, I appreciate the call-in on that one because the singularity has appeared in movies. My favorite TV show is The Big Bang Theory. They've had an episode focusing on that. So I don't know if that's where the question was launched from, but it's an interesting question. And I agree with the comments that were just made. I mean, we're not even close to addressing this. Now, for me, I still think of this, is this an artificial intelligence or is this just a remapping of architecture? So the main idea is like, I want to upload my consciousness into a machine. Well, I don't have to recreate your consciousness. I just have to be able to mimic it. So when I was mentioning just a little bit ago, hey, can we replace your neurons with something mechanical to a certain extent? If I could do that and I was now in a machine, I essentially have now put you into a machine architecture. So I've transferred you from biological to technological. And again, we don't know how to do that. But is that the artificial intelligence? I haven't really had to create something from nothing, and now it's loaded with all the knowledge about the world, interactions with people. So it's related, but to me, it's just a hair different in the aspect.
Eric Dietrich, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Sure, you bet. You're welcome.
Appreciate your food for thought. Eric Dietrich, he's a professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. He's editor of the Journal of Experimental and Theoretical Artificial Intelligence. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at how artificial intelligence has been depicted in the movies and what that really means into the future of the study of artificial intelligence. So we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many have tried to imagine a future with intelligent machines. In some cases, they have imagined a dystopian future ruled by intelligent machines. And those imaginings have become popular fodder for film.
Will's body is dying, but his mind is a pattern of electrical signals. We can upload his consciousness. We can save him.
Not like this.
Terminator! Underneath it's a hyper-alloy combat chest. Microprocessor controlled, fully armored, very tough, but outside it's living human tissue.
In an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family.
We're talking about artificial intelligence today, its promises and potential pratfalls. Still with us is OSU computer scientist Jim Davis. He is at the OSU University Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research. And joining us in the studio now is movie critic Kevin Carr. He's based in Columbus. He writes for 7M Pictures and Film School Rejects. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
We just listened to cuts from three movies about the idea of artificial intelligence, the recently released Transcendence first, then the classic Terminator from 1984, and finally the 2001 film AI, which of course stands for artificial intelligence. Kevin Carr, is there a sense of continuity for you as a film reviewer when you listen to the cuts from those three movies?
There tends to be, like you said, a dystopian angle to it. There tends to be a certain level of we messed up by putting these things in charge. And you see that with the Terminator, and you see that Transcendence. And I think before the break, one of the callers was talking about the singularity, which is what Transcendence does deal with. Mm-hmm. So while artificial intelligence, that's a little bit of the outlier. AI was a little bit of the outlier for that movie, because that one is sort of you're existing in this world where it has become real. And then it's less about the intelligence. It's more about the emotion. And that tends to be the disconnect that a lot of these movies have. You can have intelligence, but if you don't have emotion and empathy, there could be a problem.
Right. Exactly. Emotion and empathy, those are those things that are hard to define and reproduce, Jim Davis?
Absolutely, yeah. There are research teams trying to figure out, you know, what are the algorithms for emotion and the expression of the machine. So there are people working on that.
All right, so let's talk about Transcendence. That's just been recently released. I haven't seen it yet. It's what's killing me. But in no spoilers. But in Transcendence, a scientist's brain is uploaded into a computer. The plot thickens when the computer infects the internet and spreads. Eventually, it is involved with medical technology and the stock market trends. Kevin Carr, this commingling of human and machine is a recurring theme.
Yeah,
going all the way back.
Yeah, actually, if you really want to talk about artificial intelligence and building your own creation in machines, it goes back to Frankenstein, and even the book of Genesis is a story of a creation gone wrong, if you really want to look at it that way. But the idea of merging human and robotic or human and technology is a very popular thing, especially when in the 80s, when you really started to see people being able to use technology in the medical field, where you started to have pacemakers, little things put in people. And now it's not inconceivable to put microchips in people. We do it with our dogs, even though that doesn't interface with their brains.
Mm-hmm.
The technology has miniaturized enough that you can do that. And then people are now, of course, terrified to have things in them. And will it change you? And I think the big thing with Transcendence is by merging a human's brain with a computer, how do you get all of the personality out of the brain? And then how much of the computer then kind of comes in and takes over? And I think that's the overall theme, is he's not the same.
Is it the computer that's taking over, or is it the knowledge that he acquires by merging with the computer?
It would be some of the knowledge, obviously, but personality is a big one.
Yeah.
So that's actually an issue that people have talked about. When we recreate this, do we actually want all the idiosyncrasies of us inside of these machines?
Or do we want our artificial intelligence to be more perfect?
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it is that human beings, as you say, they're imperfect. But do we want to create an imperfect entity, for lack of a better term? And I think the thing that makes the scary side to the movies is you're already going to be coming in with something that's way more intelligent than any human being. And it is going to be so unrestrained in terms of thought and processing that you can't even compare. And in Transcendence, they make the point that they say that at this point, this computer was as intelligent as all the full knowledge of human intelligence since the beginning of time.
Plus, he had a personality.
And then they put a personality on him. An imperfect guy. So let's put a person's brain on there. What could go wrong?
The smartest thing in the world with a personality problem. Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I may be one of the five people that actually really liked the movie Her.
I loved Her.
Then that's two of the five, I think.
Go ahead, Beth.
But I loved it for the more of the transcendental questions that it brought up. But, I mean, I just wanted to hear what your thoughts were about it, because there were a lot of different things that he brought to the movie, and it didn't quite all come together, but I thought it was a really good attempt. That's all I have to say.
All right.
So I'll listen. Okay.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
So before we go on, Kevin Carr, can you describe the plot of Her?
Yeah, Her was Spike Jonze's film from last year. It actually made my top 10 list from last year. So
that's
I did
why
really
I had
enjoy
you on
this.
The show.
Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix plays a man in the not too distant future, undetermined, where he falls in love with his operating system, an artificially intelligent operating system on a smartphone. And it's the reason I loved it is because it was not necessarily about artificial intelligence. It was the emotional angle. And it was about, and I said, it's probably the most realistic love story you're ever going to see, especially when there's one of them that's not a real human.
Okay.
And that's what it dealt with. It dealt with bringing the emotion into it. And the character that Scarlett Johansson plays of the operating system is trying to figure out her place, what she is, how she interacts with humans and how she interacts with other operating systems. So it actually goes beyond just the raw sci-fi scariness of the machines are taking over. It's how do we incorporate them into a society if they exist.
Like the earlier AI movie.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a similar type of thing. So it's more of the story and emotion rather than the intelligence aspect.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Jim Davis, we talked earlier about Watson, the IBM supercomputer that competed on Jeopardy, and now IBM is applying that technology to the medical field, investment opportunities, and even the culinary realm, I guess. It develops unique recipes. Is there a parallel here as far as, you know, the different – is this – are they trying to teach Watson new things and from different points of view?
Teaching is an interesting word here. So the technology is still a core machine learning one by giving it lots of examples of how to distinguish one thing from another. And the big thing with Watson that I thought was really interesting is the core knowledge database, you could almost essentially say, is the internet. So when they actually did the Jeopardy tournament, they had to be fair. Mm-hmm. They could not be connected to the internet, so they essentially downloaded as much as they could. So like Wikipedia, the movie database, all of these types of things, the Bible, all of these other classic novels were downloaded, and that was its database. So again, what's great is that its mind is essentially the internet, and so it's expansive. You could take all of that. So how do you access it? Parsing the questions is hard, but it has those aspects to it. But again, do you see a personality? I mean, it wasn't cracking jokes during the match. You know, it's still very dry in a sense of what it's doing, but again, what's the purpose of it? You need to have that conversation or not.
For that made me think of that scene in The Matrix where the protagonist, Neo, had just had jujitsu downloaded in him, right?
I know kung fu.
And he goes, I know kung fu.
Great scene.
They said, well, let's see how well you do.
Yeah.
And he still had to be taught how to apply it in the world he lived in, in the world of The Matrix.
Well, and I think that's – The Matrix is an interesting thing if you want to talk about the merging of technology, of artificial intelligence and human intelligence. And, of course, this is all theoretical because this is nonsense movie stuff.
I know. We could keep turning that to
Jim
Davis.
Oh, I don't know.
Jim seems game.
and I guess the it's the merging of two systems that work completely differently. The human brain doesn't work like a computer. A lot of people
say it. But they always
say
it does.
Well, it's like a computer, but am I right? I mean,
does a lot of people treat it as an information processing device. Yeah. There's the cognitive psychology aspect from it that does that. And again, there's always two sides to the coin, but that's one of them.
Yeah, but we're not silicon-based and we don't have the ones and zeros. We store.
But that might not matter.
Okay.
That could be just like we were talking about planes earlier. Just the fact that do we have to have feathers and wings to fly? No, we bypass biology with our jet engines. We can still accomplish the task, but in a different means. Mm-hmm. So again, is the intelligence part of the mechanism or is it part of the end result?
Yeah. No, that's a good thought. That's what I've always wondered with the movies, because the movies always have to, for dramatic effect, you need to have a danger. You need to have a what's going to happen. And there's always going to be a sinister angle because, you know, who wants to see a movie where somebody makes a creation of transcendence if they made the movie and then it's like he's there, oh, I'm good, we're fine. And then you got an hour left of the movie.
Nice. Yeah.
but there's a classic point here. It's like we can design these systems and say we fold into it the need for these AI systems to minimize human suffering. We want it to help. Mm-hmm. Well, what could happen? Depending on how these things were designed and loopholes that were put in here, it could figure out, you know, I could really minimize human suffering by wiping out humanity.
Which has been done in multiple movies.
That's right.
So, the Matrix are trying to wipe out humanity, or at least having them hang around the Terminator. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very common thing. It's the idea of giving birth to a child that then becomes smarter and wiser than you and puts you in his place.
Now, there are supposedly safeguards that have been out for a long period of time. I might have to quiz you here.
Okay.
The three laws of robotics.
Yeah, Isaac
Does
Asimov.
Everybody know about
that? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. The I shall never...
A robot can't harm a human being.
Right.
Or itself.
Unless... No. So the first one is it can... Sorry.
Go on.
So basically... it cannot hurt a human or through inaction allow a human to be hurt. That's number one.
And then second one is they must preserve themselves.
That's number three. Number two is that they, they have to do what they're told.
Unless it conflicts with number one.
Unless it conflicts with number one. And number three is what you were saying here.
They have to preserve their own life.
As long as it doesn't conflict with number two or number one.
Yeah.
So that's the classic line that we all know about. So if we can put that, that's also been in TV shows and movies as well.
Right. And that's about robots. That's not necessarily about consciousness.
Well, if you're going to deal with an AI, it could still be the same thing.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. When you guys were talking about C-3PO earlier, and...
Of course, from the Star Wars movies.
Yeah, Star Wars is filled with artificial intelligence. It's just not part of the story. It's just, well, these are the beings that are inhabit this universe. So the story's not about artificial intelligence.
Right.
The way, like, 2001 is.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Let's look at 2001, because there's not an embodied... Well, I guess you could argue that it is embodied because the ship is embodied, but in the C-3PO sense, there's not a physical entity you're interacting with. But the ship, I mean, if you have... I mean, obviously, went psycho and started killing everybody. But if you had these kind of rules in here that you could safeguard it, you know, it's still an AI. I mean, right? I mean, it's the same route.
Well, but then I guess the question is, and this has been addressed in movies rather poorly in the adaptation of iRobot, but they have... brought this is out in other films. What if the computer then says, wait a minute, I know I need to preserve human life, but I'll preserve more human life by wiping out these people. Yep. And then that becomes that comes the moral dilemma. And I guess that's the big thing.
Which is one that humans face all the time.
Exactly.
It's a very human dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in artificial AI,
yeah.
That movie, the kid actually, the robot or the artificial intelligence survives mm-hmm. the end of the world.
Yeah.
And beings from, you know, aliens come to the world and they find him and they treasure him mm-hmm. as the last vestige of humanity.
Yeah. Well, and he has that humanity because he's in the story, he's given the capacity to love, which again goes back to the question of what makes a human isn't just the intelligence, which is the empathy and the emotions and the morality too.
Yeah.
Because that's a big question. War Games is another great example of, do we want a computer making decisions?
Right. Tell us about War Games.
War Games was a movie that came out in the 80s about a supercomputer that was going to take over NORAD. It was going to take over the ability and the decisions on whether or not to launch nuclear weapons. And a kid, Matthew Broderick's character, hacks in accidentally, doesn't realize he's in that, and he causes a problem. The movie originally starts with they're doing a test on whether or not they're going to launch nuclear missiles, and one of the people wouldn't pull the button or turn the key or whatever he's doing, push the button, because you needed two people to do it. And that's when they said, we can't lose the war if somebody doesn't push the button. So let's make a machine that'll do it regardless.
Okay.
And that's sort of, that takes the morality out of it, and you have to think about that. I mean, and I think that does open up, you know, that goes into greater political things now with people talking about drone strikes, because you're taking
the emotion out of it.
You're taking the human out of it.
Right.
And they may be controlling it from a long ways away, but you're now removing them from dropping a bomb on a city.
And right, what's the next step is letting them make the decisions for themselves about whether to do it.
Exactly.
That's actually happening now on the technology side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's scary. And I think do you worry that we'll get to a point, maybe not in our lifetime, but, you know, are we going to get a HAL? Are we going to get a...
Do you worry, Jim Davis?
Do I worry? I don't worry. No.
Okay. Jim Davis is not worried. Jim Davis, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
He's a researcher at the Ohio State University Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence, researching Kevin Carr, movie critic, writes for 7M Pictures and Film School Rejects. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.